Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. Honesty, humility, duty and service, combined with a deep-founded sense of right and wrong, are just some of the admirable qualities of my guest on this month's General Talk, who was commissioned into the Army in 2003 to, in his own words, play a bit of sport, make some friends, do some adventure training, and leave before there was a conflict. After four tours at the height of the war in Afghanistan, it was a spectacularly misjudged gambit. His time in operations was understandably formative, as so often is the way. "I was seeing guys get killed and blown up," he said. "I just thought that when they came home, their treatment by the government was appalling. And I felt like they deserved someone who was going to really kick the door down and make these politicians feel uncomfortable about ignoring them. And I'm going to keep banging this drum until I get sacked." Fortunately, we talked over the internet, so in welcoming Johnny Mercer, the Member of Parliament for Plymouth Moorview and Parliamentary Under-Secretary of State for Defence People and Veterans, we didn't really have a door for him to kick down in the first place. I hope you enjoy the programme.
Minister, I suppose that the logical place for us to begin, which we'll all appreciate as soldiers, is to start at the beginning. You left school and you went to work as a City of London intern, but obviously that didn't perhaps grab your attention. What was wrong with the City of London?
Oh, I thought it was tragic. You know, the idea of spending all those hours in the office doing things that I really didn't really care about at all, and then spending all my money in the pubs of London and nothing really changing week to week was absolutely not for me. I mean, to be honest, I was always going to join the military and that was a kind of temporary existence. But it certainly put me off for life, yeah.
But you don't come from a military family, is that fair to say?
So not sort of really strong military heritage stock, no. I mean, my mother and father certainly weren't in the military, but they definitely agreed with it as a career choice for their children. And three of my brothers went into the Navy.
So what was the attraction for you? Did you try the Navy? Was the Army always first choice?
It was going to be the Army for me. I've always enjoyed that sort of lifestyle, I think, before I went into the military. In the military, you're getting paid for it. I mean, I must say, I wasn't one of these sort of war nuts who read all the books and couldn't wait to go on operations. I mean, the whole idea for me was to join up, play a bit of sport, make some friends, do some adventure training, and then leave before there was a conflict. But unfortunately, it didn't really work out like that. I really only wanted to join the Gunners because I wanted to go to 2-9. I mean, I didn't really know anything about the Commando Brigade or the Brigade ethos or anything like that when I joined the military. And indeed, when I was at Sandhurst, I did look at transferring, actually, over to the Royal Marines. It's not because I didn't like the Army. I thought the Army was a fantastic institution. But the reality was I really enjoyed amphibious operations. I've always been a bit of a sea urchin. I live near to the sea now. I spend most of my time off in the summer in the sea. And, you know, that sort of manner of warfare really attracted me. So anyway, I became aware of 2-9 Commando, which is a lovely little unit down on the south coast in Plymouth. For me, that was the target, and that's why I went to the Royal Artillery. And for me, that's what the artillery was about, was 2-9.
And you saw three tours of Afghanistan at the height of the fighting. There must have been some extremely poignant moments during those tours that led you to leave the army and then to adopt the position that you did as an MP.
I went to Afghanistan in 2006, 2008, 2009, 2010. It was really busy, and it was war. You know, it was close combat. It was everything that's been talked about a million times. But you know, let's be clear. I had a wonderful time, interjected, of course, with challenging moments, and but on the whole, I'd do it all again. And, you know, but I did become very frustrated, I guess, with the way we looked after veterans in this country. So, you know, for me, it became very, very apparent that you know, you could do all your sort of drills and skills on the battlefield and engage in these close quarter combats and so on. There's just so much luck involved, right? And I was seeing guys get killed and blown up and things like that. And I just thought, obviously, that could have been me. But more to the point, I thought when they came home that their treatment by the public, who've always been fantastic on this stuff, and people like the ABF and, you know, charities saw huge sort of growth and giving, but by the government, I thought was pretty appalling. And I just felt very tied to them, to the guys and girls. And I felt like they deserved someone who was going to go and really kick the door down and make these politicians feel uncomfortable about ignoring them. And in 2012, more of our people actually took their own lives and were killed in the conflict that year, veterans. And I just thought, you know, this is insane. This has got to change. I thought about working for a charity. I thought about working for a local authority. And then I remembered meeting politicians in Afghanistan. And let's just say I didn't think the quality line was particularly high. And I thought that may hold the future for me. And I'm going to go and get elected, and I'm going to get on this this soapbox, and I'm going to keep banging this drum until I get sacked. And we're currently in that process. I very much felt that responsibility to the people I served with and fought with, and I was going to see it through.
You certainly went in on a ticket to improving the care for veterans. And in 2015, you got elected to Plymouth-Moore View. You are now, since 2019 rather, you are the Minister for Defence People and Veterans. Chance to put your money where your mouth is, so to speak, a real moment of truth. What were the challenges that you felt that you faced when you came into that office?
Veterans affairs in this country at a government level have been poor for many, many years. I mean, we didn't actually have an office for veterans affairs before I came along. And that really did have an effect on how care was granted across the country to serving personnel, veterans and their families. So when I came in, there was essentially nothing. You know, I managed to get on board a guy called David Richmond, who used to work at Help for Heroes, who's very capable. But, you know, for the first 7 or 8 months, it was just me and him, no money, nothing. We built that, and we are slowly building, but of course we have a lot further to go. What we're trying to do essentially in big handful terms is pull together all of the functions of veterans care in this country, whether it's third sector, whether it's statutory provision, whether it's the NHS, ABF, whatever it may be, and try and blend it into one offering, if you like. So the veteran who's going through the pathway, you know, doesn't really differentiate between who is who's providing him that care. The fact is that he gets that care, and it is world class. It is evidence-based. He will get better, and he can get on with the rest of his life after he's served. That's the strategic aim of what we're trying to do. It's an uphill struggle, I'm not going to lie, Harry.
But it's a huge task. 8 years ago, there were available to the minister then something like 30 civil servants. I think now you've got about 1.5 civil servants, plus your colleague David Richmond. You've got, as it were, under command, as pension holders only, as pension drawers only, at least 2.75 million veterans drawing a pension in this country. That's pension holders only. Okay. Then we've got 18,000 pensioners overseas in 65 different countries. That's, again, yeah, people who are just drawing the pension. So therefore, that is the tip of an iceberg. You have your work hugely cut out. As you say, a year ago, you established the Office for Veterans Affairs, and that is laudable. I mean, really is. You have taken on the Historic Investigations Unit, Commonwealth Veterans, Mental Health, the Armed Forces Covenant, let alone the ageing veteran population you've got. You must not sleep well at night.
I sleep very well. You know, I'll be honest, it's tough. Yeah, it is tough. It's pretty lonely. So I became an MP because I didn't like MPs. I didn't like the way they did business towards my cohort. So, you know, politics is like, people will, you know, sort of patronise you and say, yes, we should look after our people better. But what about all these arguments about free market ideology and Brexit? And if you're going to get the veterans thing on back on the stage, you have to go, well, I'm sorry, but this is equally as important. This country doing its duty by those who've served is equally as important as all these other interest areas you have. And just because you didn't fight in Afghanistan and you didn't see the sacrifices that our people made does not give you an excuse to correctly prioritize this politically. And I don't, you know, it doesn't really, I mean, it has taken a toll over the last year, I'll be honest. I find being in government very, very challenging indeed. To be honest, like before that, it didn't, because I genuinely, like, there's no self-interest in this for me. So I don't mind kind of taking the hits, because I don't sort of sit there and work out my career to being prime minister or whatever it may be. I'm here to do a job, right? And I'm doing it on behalf of people who aren't as lucky and don't have the opportunities that I do. And that kind of boosts me in a way to get out there and win these arguments, because I'm not kind of doing it for myself. When it's for yourself, I think sometimes you can think, I've got 25% of what I wanted, so I'm going to back off. Actually, I think to myself, do you know what? These guys have, like, why should I settle for 25% of what they wanted? Actually, you know, you do what you said you were going to do. Otherwise, I'm just going to keep campaigning from the back benches and things like that. So I've learned a lot. I've definitely learned a lot. I haven't got everything right. But I think we are making real incremental strategic progress, but at a pace I'm definitely not happy with, and I'll be addressing that in the months ahead.
You've spoken about how you want the Veterans Agency to re-engage with the veterans. If we could just take one or two sort of points at a go. The Historic Investigations Unit, a particularly pernicious organisation whose job is to dig out historic events at the time and go back over people acting under fire often and under orders. How do you assess progress with either calming or taming the Historic Investigations Unit?
I think we've made great progress on Iraq and Afghanistan, and the bill that's coming through the House of Commons at the moment is sensible, fair, proportionate, and will ensure that some of the experiences, the most egregious experiences you've seen of our people being investigated for 18 years and destroying them as an individual, that will not happen again. It weighs heavily on my mind and my heart, the Northern Ireland experience, okay? And it's difficult because the way government is currently constituted, I can have no effect in that arena, despite the Prime Minister asking me to, despite the very clear commitments we've made as a government, I can have no effect. So what I've tried to do is extract certain sort of lines out of the Northern Ireland office, for example, promising to equal treatment for those who serve in Northern Ireland and those who are covered in my bill in the overseas operations environment. But progress is not where it should be, is the reality of it. And at some point I need to make a decision about what to do about that. But it's something I think about every day. The experience for these people is unacceptable. It is a hallmark of political weakness. And whilst the gains in Northern Ireland, the Good Friday Agreement and so on are fantastic, right? The days of veterans being the only cohort not represented at the table, I'm afraid are over. And I must say the Prime Minister on this is very clear, but it is an intractable problem. I'm determined to solve it.
Well, that's very noble. Another mark of progress has been your recent announcement about Commonwealth veterans and residency. Can you just outline again how what we've achieved so far, what you've achieved so far in the great Commonwealth veteran story? Because of course their allegiance to the crown, yet their inability to get residency and so on is a travesty. And you've recently made some good inroads into that.
Yeah, I think we're making progress. This has been an issue for a while. This isn't one of those things where somebody's made a decision and there's been secondary and tertiary effects they haven't thought about and people have been discriminated against. This is where visa fees have built up. Nobody's really got a grip of it and nobody's really understood what it's like to be a foreign and Commonwealth serviceman or veteran in this country. It's the same old problem of not understanding what it's like to be a veteran, right? So, and I've got myself in all sorts of trouble on this by saying things like it's consistently been an argument between the Home Office and Defence Department. Well, the reality is it has been for many, many years, you know, and now actually they're working together to try and solve this. I'm confident a public consultation will happen in the next couple of weeks. People will then feed into that, and I'd encourage everyone listening to your show to feed into that. And hopefully we can get a resolution that means that those who serve their country can actually live here afterwards. I mean, you know, pretty low bar in my book, but, you know, let's see what we can do.
It does seem only right, but I am, of course, talking from a position of say, of strength, because I'm a veteran, but I'm not a Commonwealth veteran. And it does seem to me that if you fought for your country or served your country, even, that is something that should be due to it. And you agree. So what I can say, Minister, in that sense, is keep being a pain in the arse. let's talk about the Armed Forces Covenant. This is the government's promise to its armed forces and its veterans to treat them fairly. They should be treated with decency and respect, which, of course, is part of ABF, the Soldiers' Charities remit and charter. This is now going to be set, I think, into law. Of course, one of the problems about that, as I understand, and I stand to be corrected on this, is that it will remove an individual's ability to sue the government in case of, say, poor equipment on operations or whatever. Am I correct in that?
No, I mean, the issue around the, you're conflating two things there. So there's the Armed Forces Covenant Bill and there's the Overseas Bill, right? The Overseas Bill is coming for a lot of flack because people don't really understand why our people got investigated so many times. They don't really understand what they're asking for either. So a lot of the criticism I get, particularly from senior folk, is that you're not stopping investigations. Well, if I was to stop investigations, that's called an amnesty, and nobody would go for that either. So what you have to do is come up with a very carefully calibrated piece of legislation, and a five-year presumption not to prosecute is good. What that means is that those serving on operations will get a level of protection, but not complete protection, right? So if they break the law, they're absolutely going to be held to account. And if you come to the MOD with new evidence of law breaking, I mean, what sort of organization would not investigate itself? And wouldn't want to be part of that organization anyway. So, you know, does that affect soldiers' ability to claim against the MOD? The challenge you have is that if you work in Tesco's, okay, you will, for the rest of your life, with no time limit, be able to sue Tesco's if you slip over and hurt yourself. Okay, yes, there will be a five-year limit of presumption not to prosecute for operational service. But I have to look at it in the round and say, actually, do I want my soldiers exposed to lawfare? Okay, or do I want to put this five-year process in, of which 93% of claims come in under anyway, and then go on a huge effort to make sure people understand that you've got your 5 years and you need to use it if there's a problem, and then protect them from lawfare, viewed in the round? Is that the right thing to do? Of course it is. But people focus on different parts of the legislation which speak to them and their cohort, and then get very upset about it. And I understand that, but the reality is I'm dealing with a very specific problem, which is the commercialization of lawfare to make public money, essentially, off the back of our service people. And that's what this legislation is designed to stop. It's a good piece of legislation, and I suspect it will come law in the next couple of months.
Good stuff. Well, I mean, I suppose it does also, it underlines the enormity of the problem that the challenge you've set yourself. We've spoken a lot about Afghanistan and Iraq and even Northern Ireland, but we have not covered the enormous area of aging veterans and their health. Those who were from the Second World War, from the 1950s, the 1960s. Well, what is your view on veterans and their care?
Look, I think they're an example to my generation. I think cultures have changed over the years. They are the greatest generation, not my generation. They are the greatest generation. I think that on the whole, the NHS has provided well for them. But there are no doubt that there are particularly challenging areas where we can do more to support veterans of that age. And I'm really clear that whilst, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq are in the news, well, they're not really anymore, but, you know, and it's very visceral and everyone makes films about it. You know, actually, the majority of our veterans are still of that age. They have very different needs. And, you know, I'm really hard over on accommodating and designing services for them to make sure they're looked after. Their duty to this country has been immense, and the duty that the country has to them in return should be the same. So, look, I know there's a lot of focus on contemporary veterans, and obviously I'm of that age, but I am not blind to the fact that we're in a minority, and I have a duty to all veterans.
As you said, in your last year of service, more soldiers or more military personnel died from suicide than did on operations. This is a very sensitive area, and I know you are devoting a lot of assets and resources to mental health.
Yeah, people have shied away from it for many years. I've always got a slightly different approach to dealing with suicide, you know, both inside and outside the military. You know, I remember when I campaigned in Plymouth to get a sign on the Tamar Bridge just to point people to where they could go for help if they were thinking of taking their own life. And there's a huge resistance to it. And I found that within the military community as well. And, you know, if we're really going to take it on and understand suicide and why it goes on, I mean, it is the biggest killer of men under 44. Clearly we have a lot of work to do on it. Look, each one of these suicides, right, the way I look at it, it's obviously a tragedy for the individual, okay, and their family. But it's a huge tragedy for us as an institution. Like, we don't want people going away from their time in service and taking their own life because of something that's happened in service, right? So we have to apply ourselves to it and understand what the problem is. The reality of the data is, A, we didn't have any, right? And it's pretty poor. But B, now we have gathered it, started gathering it and looking at it, you are less likely to take your life if you're serving than if you are in the civilian cohort. There is a population of those who experienced combat in Afghanistan and Iraq who do seem to have a higher instance of suicide. And that's why, you know, I talk about this at every opportunity. We've set up really clear care pathways. Operation Courage, which I launched a couple of weeks ago, is the first time the NHS has really pulled together all of its mental health delivery under one front door, if you like, so that people know where they're going, they're going to get looked after. And it's right the way through talking therapies up to a high intensity service that's really looking after people. You know, so the offer is changing. There is help out there. We've just got to make it easier to access that help and easier for people to understand what those care pathways are. But look, it's not. Also, I would say that you know, you are less likely to take your life if you've served, and you know, and suicide is not, you know, in America, for example, 22 veterans a day. It is an epidemic. Okay, it is not that in the UK. It is another part of the veterans challenge. But this idea that there's you know, an epidemic of veteran suicide is simply not true. It's a challenge, and we will deal with it. And I think we're beginning to make real inroads towards that.
And as you say, the good news is, or the encouraging news is, that it is a falling figure against the civilian population. Is that fair to say?
It is fair to say that in every cohort outside of a specific cohort who deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan, you are less likely to take your life if you serve. And that data has only changed in the last 6 months. 6 months ago, you were less likely to take your life if you serve, statistically. So, you know, it's actually, you know, a pretty positive story to tell. But for me, like, each one is an absolute tragedy. And I'm determined to do everything we can, excepting you're never going to really stop the whole thing. But I'm going to make sure we strain every sinew to catch every individual.
Well, that's very noble.
People shy away from this subject, and I think it's unfortunate. I really do, because I imagine it's an incredibly lonely place. And I think that we kind of have to be slightly more aggressive in our approach towards it, you know, and kind of not let the sort of darkness take over of it being this taboo subject you don't talk about. It is clearly an awful experience, and people feel incredibly lonely. And it must be very, very dark. And I've seen somebody take their life, and it was awful. I think we have to engage with it, and to not do so would be, you know, a degree of cowardice, I think.
A dereliction of duty, I suppose. Yes, I think you're right in saying that. And I think also it is a function of leadership. Is it well for everyone?
It's a function of leadership. It absolutely is a function of leadership. You know, we look at mental health, fitness and resilience completely differently these days. You know, the old way of thinking of, you know, just cracking your fears and having a few beers in the squadron bar, you know, we are now an operationally more capable army, military, because we take things like mental fitness and resilience seriously, because we think about what we're asking our people to endure, long periods of separation at times. Sometimes it might just be, or it might be 7 months of close combat. You know, whatever it is, we want to train our people up so they have the resilience and mental fitness to deal with that stuff. Those are the big lessons from Afghanistan and Iraq, and we now have them in place. And, you know, in April, mandatory mental fitness training takes place every year for every single service personnel. So, look, we are making progress, but clearly we have more to do.
Finally, you are now in the chair doing what you set out to do. What next for Johnny Mercer?
I genuinely don't really think about that. I think about what next for veterans. And I will keep campaigning on this furrow, I'm afraid, because whilst, yes, we've set up the Office for Veterans Affairs, we've made real progress. The last 18 months have been extremely challenging in the way we're currently configured in terms of what we want to deliver for our veterans in terms of making this the best country in the world to be a veteran. We are perhaps 20-25% of the way there. So I know it sounds like really silly, and people, it's hard for people to understand, but like I genuinely don't have any self-interest in this. I do enjoy the fight, I'll be honest. I enjoy the scrap on behalf of our people. My views on politicians have not changed. If anything, they've got worse. And I will keep going until we either do our duty by our people, or B, you know, someone else comes along and does it better, and I'm more than happy for that to happen. You know, I definitely find politics a challenge, but we'll keep going for now.
You have been a best-selling author with We Were Warriors. Do you think there's another book in Johnny Mercer yet?
I do enjoy writing, and I enjoy the long form of writing where you have the opportunity to articulate an argument rather than the sort of silliness we see in the newspapers. And yeah, you know, those options have presented themselves. I think there's a big world out there and there's lots to be done. But look, I'm committed to this. And, you know, I've never really been half cocked about anything. I set this as my objective. We're some of the way there. We've got a lot further to go. I'm sure it'll all end in a rather spectacular, colourful explosion. But we'll see when that is.
Well, hopefully tea and medals, isn't it? Johnny, thank you. Minister, thank you very much indeed for being so frank and honest with us.
If you feel overwhelmed or are no longer able to cope, you can contact Op Courage, the Veterans Mental Health and Wellbeing Service, by Googling NHS Veterans, or you can get help by calling 111. In an emergency, visit A&E or call 999. If you're still serving, you can also call the Military Mental Health Helpline on 0800 323 4444. I say again, 0800 323 4444. And remember, it is okay to reach out. We are all here to help. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast and would like to learn more about the work of the Soldiers Charity or to take part in its many events, please visit soldierscharity.org. And from me, Harry Bucknell, on behalf of us all at ABF, the Soldiers Charity, thank you for listening. With editing by Michael Stiglianu, this podcast has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldiers Charity.